From the Sky News Centre at 6. Transport Minister Joe Johnson has resigned from the government over Brexit. Boris Johnson's brother says Theresa May's plans would leave Britain out of Europe and yet wholly subject to European rules. He says the PM's ideas are unacceptable for a proud democracy such as our own and is calling for a people's vote.
The deal that's being finalised at the moment in Brussels and across Whitehall is so radically different to what was proposed in the referendum campaign that I think it's really important the public is given a chance to confirm that this is indeed the extraordinary basis on which they want to leave the European Union.
The Prime Minister, meanwhile, has laid wreaths at the graves in Belgium of the first and last British soldiers to be killed in the First World War. She's also met President Emmanuel Macron in France for further commemorations. Australian police have shot and killed a man who stabbed three people, one of them fatally, in a terror attack in Melbourne. Detectives say the assailant was known both to police and to Australia's security agency. The Grenfell Tower inquiry has heard a distressing 999 call made by a father who was desperate to escape the fire with his family. Marcio Gomez, his wife and two daughters, did make it out, but he says the disaster will probably scar his children. This is the call he made.
Where's the firemen? Are they there?
Rose.
They're in the stairwell.
It's claimed town centres are suffering their worst period for 5 years as yet more high street stores close. A report suggests they shut at a rate of almost 14 a day during the first half of this year. That's the latest. I'm Andy Hayes.
Some more Bristol music on BCFM 93.2.
This is Bristol. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem leader, councillor for Cotham, Anthony Negus. After the 7 o'clock news, 500,000 dead so far, at least in the war on terror. And this is Brown's University, Rhode Island, American University, telling us. Plus, 100 years, apparently, of the GRU, the Russian Military Intelligence Service. We hear from Mark Galliati from the Institute for International Affairs in Prague. And President Macron calling for a true European army. Plus, the EU Coast Guard is being taken over by a company from Israel, Elbit Systems Limited, at a cost of nearly $70 million. They plan to patrol the European coastlines with their drones. Plus, Democrats get a big increase in their vote, but the Republicans increase their hold on the Senate. Does that make any sense? In the US midterms. So more people vote for you, so you get less candidates. How does that work? Once elected, do people actually do what they said they would before they were elected? Is US democracy past its sell-by date? Plus, the real stuff. What if everything we thought we knew about the world was wrong? Is it just modern wars that are started by deception and fought for resources and profit rather than principles? We hear tonight from William Stewart on wars being planned up to 120 years before they happen, he believes, and the role of the British East India Company. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's after seven. So, helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem leader and councillor for Cotham, Anthony Negus. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Nice to be here.
First of all, Anthony, you were saying just before we came on air that you've been to a meeting about innovation at the council. Now, that sounds a little bit like spin to me. If you're going to a meeting about innovation, that's got to be good, hasn't it?
Yeah, why shouldn't local authorities be creative and do things a different way and look at pulling in ideas from people that might have a different idea about doing things?
So, but what it's not just about that, it's also commercialisation, isn't it? So that isn't quite the same thing. If you're commercialising a local authority, then some people might say, well, that's not appropriate.
Oh, I think if we keep our minds very firmly on what we need to be doing, which is providing services for people and to provide a better place to live, then we've got to find the money to finance that. And that money isn't coming in the normal way. We've got to find ways to make it come in.
So just take us through some of the things that you've been talking about in this little group, commercialisation and innovation. It sounds, to me, that sounds like you're kind of sugarcoating something which could actually involve things like taking away services, job losses, and also trying to get more money out of the people who live in the city rather than provide more services.
I think it just tries to make use of where Bristol is strongest. Bristol is, if you like, a sort of a brand. It's got a mass of people that it communicates with through its taxpayers. It's got,
we're not Coca-Cola, are we?
Enormous reach. It's got.
Well, are we just like
just
another
look
Coca-Cola?
At what, just look at what we can do and where we are placed, and it gives us opportunities to do things and to sell and produce and market some of our existing services in a better way.
Okay, so why is the Bristol brand different to Coca-Cola?
I sincerely hope the Bristol brand is radically different from Coca-Cola. I think that was a very provocative remark.
Good, I hope so.
Well,
that's what we do here, but don't
expect me to put... And remember, I'm not running this council. I'm just trying to support it through a very difficult period, and I think we can do a lot better in the way we do things. And commercialisation and innovation are linked, because if we do things the way we've always done them, we wouldn't be commercialising. Innovation gives us an opportunity to do things like that in a different way.
Okay, we talked about it in a broad brush approach. Well, what about anything specific?
I'll tell you about a specific thing that I've been bringing to this group, and that is trying to generate energy from the floating harbour. We've got opportunities in the floating harbour when it's full up with water and the cut is empty, of discharging that water through turbines and generating energy. It then discharges through the cut and out to sea. And we have within the floating harbour the ability to drop the level of the floating harbour. It's about 300 acres in total, the surface area, by about a foot in old terms. That is a massive amount of water that can be taken through turbines, and we can generate energy from that.
How much energy?
We're going through the process of trying to sort all that out, and we don't know at the moment how much it's going to cost. One thing I will tell you is it won't take conventional turbines. It'll probably take something which are like helical turbines, where the whole tube is actually turning and generating energy as the water passes through it. There's going to have to be a lot of innovation here in order to make this commercially viable. But I think that's a prospect we need to look at. It will take a partner. Obviously, Bristol wouldn't have the ability to run all this completely itself, but it's putting money into it and making it go.
Well, hang on a minute, because if it can make money and if it's our resource to use, surely we should be, as a city, investing in it, and we will then get the returns, not some private business.
There's a limit on the way that money can be invested on certain things within the city. There's a limit on how much we can borrow and the way we borrow and what we use that borrowing for. So we've got to be sensible about how we can use expertise and different sorts of borrowing in order to create opportunities for the city, hence the innovation.
So you're not nervous about this whole idea of commercialising the city council?
No, I'm not. I think it's right that it should be scrutinised. There should be a governance system that makes sure that we're not being outrageous. But if ultimately it's firmly fixed on delivering services in a way, in a better way, in a more extensive way, and doing better for our taxpayers, I'm certainly not going to gainsay it.
Martin?
Well, I think it's a question of proof of the pudding's in the eating, isn't it, with all these kind of ideas? I mean, they're either viable or they're not. And, I don't really have much to add to that. I mean, the problem is that what I do worry about is that we're pursuing inappropriate commercialisation because we cannot raise money. You know, really, the real problem is that central government doesn't fund, as it should, local authorities to do what they should do.
Is that right, Anthony?
Well, that's been true for a very long time. Yeah. Even if you go down the old route of how money is raised through the rating system has been shot through of holes for many, many years. And the only way that system's going to work, even though Bristol now has much more control over its own business rates, for example, and all the money's being generated in Bristol and not from a central government grant, nevertheless, the rating system, if we're going to depend on that system, it needs to be seriously overhauled because it's still based on values of about 20 years ago.
So isn't it this just a workaround for what's happening with the lack of funding from central government? You're saying, oh, well, we're a bit desperate for money. Let's just look for any way to raise it.
Local authorities and most organisations, if you look at any voluntary group or anything like even a scout troop or something like that, are all short of money. There have to be found ways of trying to make these things work. And if you can't just keep asking people to dip in their pockets all the time and provide the extra. You have to be resourceful and find new ways of looking at this.
Martin Summers, I mean, the big corporations aren't short of money, are they? People like Amazon, people like that, they're starting to fund all sorts of things. They're awash with cash.
Well, and also, and you've got Capita and Carillion and so on hanging around to try and muscle in on this. Carillion is not
hanging around anymore.
No, indeed. But I mean, the thing is, I mean, the basic problem is that local government isn't properly financed. Hasn't been for a long time. The abolition of the rating system, because it's council tax, as you now know, and that's much more regressive than the rates. And of course, in Northern Ireland, they still have the old-fashioned rates because they didn't change the system. They didn't dare. And that means, of course, that the local government over there is better financed because it's just much easier to collect tax on property than it is chasing lots of individuals who haven't got any money, which is the downside of council tax. And of course, a lot of things like that were done in the 80s, which were silly, including stopping building council houses and so on. And of course, we need a new deal for local authorities, but I think we'll need a new government for that to happen.
Do you ever feel?
I wouldn't say that, because I think all of these things that you've talked about with governments of all ilks have not actually grasped the nettle of how we actually finance local government. Government to a national to the Westminster government is a very mixed bag. It actually produces most of the money in this country comes from what happens in cities and the larger authorities. But if government were to allow that to have a free rein, it would no longer be able to control the finances properly. So there's a balancing central and local,
Anthony,
a balancing act.
Do you ever feel regrets about austerity back in 2010 with Nick Clegg and David Cameron?
Not then.
And obviously George Osborne.
Well, I mean, then I think that the situation was that we were absolutely on our uppers. We certainly had a great deal more debt per capita than any other European country. In fact, we still do, as far as I'm aware, have a greater debt per capita than certainly Spain, Italy, and I'm not sure about Greece now. I think we've actually probably got better than Greece now.
So do you blame that on the previous government, on Gordon Brown? Was that the problem?
Well, two things happened. I think we had a financial crash, and I still think the jury's out on how that came about, as to whose responsibility it was. There was certainly deregulation, and somebody took their eye off the ball, and it went right round most of the world. And I'm not sure that you could point the finger at anybody particularly for that, but the fact is that for the preceding years and the 2 years after, when that government was still running, the money that was being thrown around, not just to solve the financial crash, but in other respects as well, was injudicious at that time. And it meant that, as the man said, there's no money left. And it left us in a situation where we absolutely on our uppers. The cost of financing that debt was about the cost of the National Health Service.
Well, we always like to have some of the senior figures on this programme, not just you, Anthony, but also Christine Lagarde from the International Monetary Fund. And the BBC did a 10 years since austerity programme. It was called After the Crash. I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And let's have a listen to a little extract there now from that programme where the presenter talks to Christine Lagarde from the IMF and then also to the author, British author, on a book about after the crash, Alan Tews.
The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which for so many is still regarded as the source of austerity policies, in the case of Greece and other countries, argued that the terms were too strict. The head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, thinks you have to weigh financial considerations against the broader impact on society.
There is that subtle balance between the necessary fiscal consolidation and the imperative of social cohesion as well. And I think where that balance lays is with the minimum level of social protection and the minimum predictability that people have about things such as pensions, wages, and so on and so forth. And how you determine that is actually going to drive the speed at which consolidation takes place, the period of time over which it does.
Whereas being part of the euro currency union is a reason why Southern Europe adopted austerity policies, it does not explain why the UK, after initially enthusiastically advocating stimulation, from 2010 imposed austerity. Many question why Europe and the UK, home to Keynes, did not heed his advice, whereas the US and China had been such effective students. Here's Adam Tooze, author of Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World.
The European turn to austerity in 08-09 and after is going to puzzle historians, I think, in the future. It's a genuine riddle. It looks like an exercise in self-harm. It's very difficult to avoid the impression that at this point, other interests and other dogmatic ideas about how economic policy ought to be organised are gained the upper hand. And that's really the big difference, and that's really where the crucial mistake is made. And that is driven in very large part, I think, by a kind of misguided focus on the long run, when what really needed to happen was to focus on the short-run costs of very dramatically slowing down the recovery. You end up with an extremely anemic recovery with low productivity, not just low output, but low productivity growth, which has continued all the way down to the present day.
Martin?
Well, Adam Tooze is a very good historian, and of course his analysis is absolutely correct.
Is that
correct.
Because he agrees with you?
Yes, of course. Why would I suggest otherwise? I mean, I have read his stuff. I haven't read this latest book, but I've read his book about, for example, the German economy during the Second World War. But of course, to come to the main point about austerity, I interviewed Nick Clegg when it just has happened.
Before we go there, can you just answer that? Because the question he's posing there is, it seemed like, looking at it from now, and Anthony's hinting at this too, looking back on it, what he's saying is it looks like self-harm. It looked completely unnecessary at the time.
Well, I'm just going to explain that. I interviewed Nick Clegg for this programme just as he became Deputy Prime Minister. And if you remember, I said, what you're going to do is lose the country's AAA credit rating because you're trying to cut public expenditure too far, too fast. He didn't understand the question, and then very soon after, 18 months later, we did lose the AAA credit rating, not for because we were showing fiscally discipline. I must finish this point,
Tony. To be fair to Nick Clegg, you did take about 2 minutes to ask the question.
Let me just point out, but what Tooze is pointing out is that Keynesian economics was thrown out of the window by the Thatcherite era, and in actual fact, it doesn't make sense to cut in public expenditure in a recession. All that happens then is you actually increase the pain, but you don't solve the problem. Now, what's actually happened is we haven't reduced the deficit in one parliamentary term. We're in the third parliamentary term now, and it's still not quite gone. And that's the only way to do it. And that's, in other words, they were forced by the markets to take the correct procedure, which was not to try and do it all in one go. And of course, the Liberals encouraged the idea of doing it all in one go because they joined the coalition to do exactly that and then failed and lost the country's AAA credit rating, which then increased the interest that we have to pay on the debt. I tell you who people should read about all of this is Simon Wren-Lewis, who writes a blog called Mainly Macro. He's used to work at the Treasury. He's somebody that I take very seriously. And, of course, most people don't understand these fundamental economic points. They think if you just cut public expenditure, that solves the problem.
Martin, actually economics is a bit of a dark art, isn't it?
Well, what happens is that most,
a practitioner,
most people basically think that the national economy functions just like their private business or their own private finances. A-level students learn that in actual fact it doesn't. And the dimmer ones never get that. And of course it's quite clear that Osborne and Clegg didn't get it. And that's why they lost the country's AAA credit rating, which puts us in further in the hole than we should have been otherwise.
You've had a bit of a go at the Lib Dems there. We've got Anthony.
Well, I'm just answering the point.
Lib Dem leader here. So before we hear from Anthony, let's hear from your man, Jeremy Corbyn, who last week at Prime Minister's Questions, because there wasn't one this week, was talking, guess what, about austerity.
And when he talks about helping those who are on low incomes, yes, we're helping people who are on low incomes. We're saving people money by freezing fuel duty. That's been opposed by the Labour Party. We're letting people keep more of the tax, of the money they earn by cutting income tax. That's been opposed by the Labour Party. The Right Honourable Gentleman keeps claiming that he's backing working people. But I say to him again, if he wants to put more money into people's pockets, if he wants to take care of working people, he should vote for the Conservative budget on Thursday.
I'm really not very clear whether that was a yes or a no, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister once claimed to be concerned about burning injustices. Well, that concern's fizzled out well, hasn't it? This was, Mr. Speaker, a broken promise budget. The Prime Minister pledged to end austerity at her party conference, and the Chancellor failed to deliver it in this House. The cuts continue. Those on lower incomes will be worse off as a result of this budget. Austerity has failed and needs to end now. But, Mr. Speaker, it's very clear. Only Labour can be trusted to end austerity and end the cuts to those on lowest incomes and invest in our country again. So now we know councils, schools, police, prisons, public sector workers and those reliant on social security will face years of austerity. Will she apologise for her broken promise that she was going to end austerity because she has failed to do that?
First of all, the Right Honourable Gentleman talked about my commitment to tackling burning injustices. Yes. Oh, yes, they say from the front bench opposite. Indeed. Was it Labour that introduced the Modern Slavery Act? No, it was me. Was it Labour that made sure that people in mental health crisis were not being taken to police cells as a place of safety? No, it was me. Was it the Labour Party? Was it the Labour Party that introduced the race disparity audit so for the first time we can see what's happening to people from across our communities in this country? No, it was me and this government. And I'll tell him what else this government has done. I'll tell him what else this government has done. By taking a balanced approach to the economy, careful financial management, what do we see? Borrowing down, unemployment down, income tax down. Oh, up, they say. Well, I'll tell them what's gone up. Support. As long as it takes, I'm going to tell you. Support for public services up, growth up, wages up, debt is falling, austerity is ending. Under the Conservatives, the hard work of the British people is paying off.
Anthony?
Gosh, what do you want me to say about all that?
I want you to say...
That was straight out of kindergarten, wasn't it? Haven't you seen kids organised so that they actually make the right responses at the right time? My goodness.
I mean, do you think the Conservatives have decided to end austerity now?
Well, how would I know? I mean, that's a Conservative government with which I have no relationship at all. I can only read like you do what's in the newspapers. I got an A-level in economics. I mean, I don't go much farther than that.
I think the most telling thing, which neither of them mentioned, is the top rate tax cuts in the budget, which the Liberal Democrats, of course, opposed. And then some people on the Labour side decided they weren't going to oppose them for whatever triangulation reasons there might be. But how can you turn around to all these people and say there's no money for you for this, this, this and this? But meanwhile, for the richest people in the country, by definition, money for you because you fund our party. Couldn't be clearer. Of what the ideological basis of things now are, whatever people thought was happening in the coalition era.
Look, I think there is some merit in trying to make sure that you can recycle money in a way that's going to do good, and in some cases, entrepreneurs and all the rest That money can be turned around. But in the general rule, I agree with you. If people can afford to pay more for what is needed in this country, those are the people that should be tackled first. And I don't see that happening.
No, it's not happening, is it?
We are heading in the wrong direction. But I think this is going to take not just major structural changes in this country to address the tax to the people that are most able to pay it, but it's going to take international action as well to try and sort out the problems with Amazon and Google and people like this that are just generally pitching tent around the world wherever they want to, wherever they're going to get the best deal and whenever they can persuade the most people that it's the right place to be. And that needs serious international cooperation.
Well, let's just try and bring this down to the real world. And I'm not saying you're not talking about that.
We're
talking about specifics now. A story which broke in the Daily Mirror, it's been picked up by various others in the Metro. It's gone national now, and it's based from a charity in Torbay. And support is growing around the country for a 9-year-old girl who begged a homeless charity for a job. They've now raised over £22,000 after speaking about a 9-year-old girl who begged them for work to buy Christmas presents for her siblings. A little girl told the chief executive of Humanity Torbay, Ellie Waugh, that she needed a job because her mother had died and her father had no money. The charity, which operates a food bank and offers support for the vulnerable, has managed to raise now £22,800 after she decided to hit out at Universal Credit and tell the truth about how many people are being forced to sleep rough. She said in an emotional video posted on the GoFundMe page, "I'm speaking out because I've actually been threatened and I've been told to keep my mouth shut," which most people know this is the charity leader. "I find it really difficult to do, especially when it comes to truth and justice." And they're giving out lots of sleeping bags and tents to people down in Torbay, Martin.
Well, I mean, this story is really about Universal Credit, leaving aside the human interest aspect of a 9-year-old girl begging for work. Universal Credit's been pretty disastrous, not least the waiting period that people, you know, it was 6 weeks, it's now been reduced to 5, but that means that anybody who claims it is immediately in rent arrears, which then puts them, which is why basically homelessness has gone up. And it's an obvious design flaw, but they won't change it because of their basically ideological attitude towards deserving, undeserving, poor and all the rest of it.
I noticed, by the way, they're just talking now in Italy about bringing in this universal basic income. Brussels are telling them, no, you're not allowed to, and we'll have a war over it if you really want. What do you make of the idea of just making sure everybody's got enough to live on, Anthony? Is it feasible, or is it just pie in the sky?
I think it's part of the practice in Norway, isn't it? I think Norway has done this. I think there's other countries as well that certainly be looking at it. I don't know. I can't tell you real off which ones it is. Universal Credit is a worthy attempt to try and solve a number of problems. We thought we had the technology to make it work much better than it did. I find that if you try and do something, you have to make sure that you've got the ability to mitigate what falls out of it before you can finally fix it. The problem with Universal Credit, it hasn't been able to do that. It has found problems. They've come up that the timetable problem is a very serious one, and that it has come up, and we have. I think the government has found a small amount of money, but nothing like enough.
Yeah, but the critics are saying, Anthony, the critics are saying that the problem with Universal Credit right from the start has been that it's too easy just to cut people off from it. And then all of a sudden you're in a situation where you were trying to better yourself, get more of an income or whatever, and suddenly you find yourself being threatened with eviction, like that.
It is massively complicated, but all
and
of
this
these,
is why we've got so
all
many people
of these
on
sanctions
the streets
and other problems
because people
all,
are being evicted
all
because
of
these Universal
sanctions
Credit.
And other problems were coming were all also inherent in the previous system. And what's not been done properly is that those have been ironed out in the new system.
So Universal Credit was never a system designed to make it easier to evict people and cut them off from any kind of support then?
Well, I doubt it very much. I didn't invent it. I didn't administer it. But I would think it's extremely unlikely that that was an intention, if that's what you're saying. It's got problems, and those problems need to be addressed And at the moment, the problems which I think a lot of people could see and some that they couldn't have not got the wherewithal to address them.
When a 9-year-old phones up a charity begging for work because she needs to feed her family, that shows that that child is extremely vulnerable, Martin.
Yeah, but I mean, we shouldn't focus on one particular case, although it's obviously a very shocking case, and there's many others. I think the fundamental problems, I come back to the point I made earlier, in the previous system, when you applied for housing benefit, if you'd been made redundant, they would give you money from the day that you applied, so that you could keep your housing. Under Universal Credit, because Ian Duncan Smith wanted to make it difficult to apply for, you have to wait 6 weeks. I had to wait 9 weeks because I actually applied for it and they wouldn't let me apply until I'd got paid at the end of the month I'd been made redundant. So I had to wait 9 weeks without any income at all, and then you don't get that money back. You can't turn to your landlord and say, in 9 weeks' time, I'm going to pay you. 9 weeks with no money at all. And of course, for people with no money, that means a lot. Of course, Ian Duncan Smith can probably borrow it off his friends, but the people that he's talking about can't.
Well, he's
the whole
quite
fundamental
a few bank accounts. He doesn't have to borrow.
Well, and the point about this is that the whole ideology behind it has been one of punishment of the poor. You've got to remember when he was pushing this forward, they were deliberately trying to switch attention from the bankers who have massively been bailed out. All those who have assets in this country have been bailed out by quantitative easing and low interest rates, and that is basically a bailout. And the richest have been bailed out, and the poorest have been deliberately targeted. Now that's causing enormous resentment. Let's call it class war, if you like, from the top.
Well, look, if you've got a few bob left at the end of the week, then you might have enough to pay to go on a first bus, because the whole idea, apparently, is being to make fares easier and cheaper, but actually it's making them more expensive. The idea of having a £2 flat fare, for those that don't know, used to be for a short journey was £1.50 single, and then for a longer journey was £2.50, and that what they've done is they've said we'll have just a £2 flat fare. The problem being that actually most people that use the bus were using the shorter fares, so the average fare for anybody has gone up.
I'm afraid that's true.
So is an article by Tristan Cork in the Bristol Post today saying why the £2 flat fare on Bristol's buses might actually cost you £2.07 because of their various ways to buy this through apps and online and mobile phones that run out of battery power just before you're about to get on the bus, so you can't get on the bus and you have to walk home. Have you had that one? That's great fun. So it might actually not be £2 at all, Anthony. What do you make of what's been going on with the buses? Because they've had all sorts of problems with lack of drivers, buses just simply not turning up for months now.
I've never had so many complaints about bus cancellations as I've had in the last 3-4 months. And as a matter of interest, the same thing applies to bin collection as well, which has been an absolute disaster for the last 3 or 4 months. Even since we had the hot weather and all the problems with, extra hydration and everything else. It's been since then that's been a problem too. But back to the buses. We know that the First Bus have admitted to having 112 drivers short in their operational area. We have a system now where buses are being taken off. In my own ward, the number 9 bus is being reduced. That means that there are people in my ward that have to walk a very long way to get to another bus, up hills and down hills. And these are a lot of these people that use the buses are elderly people or people that basically need a bus, and they are being deprived of that. And that's the system is shot, because we are not developing this city a bus network and a bus system that actually does what we want it to do, and take the money from that and spread it around the system so it can all work. With a deregulated system, that's impossible, and it means that the profits on the bits of the route which are earning the most money cannot be spread into buses that are not services that are not making money. This is a rotten system.
There's one person who's really sort of in charge of all of this, and that's a guy called Tim Bowles. We don't hear very much of. He's supposed to be one of the people who's in charge of the strategy in transport. He's the Metro Mayor.
Well, he's taking a very, very long time to ease into his position, which is...
What's he been doing? Twiddling his thumbs?
No one's seen much of Tim Bowles, and certainly no one's heard much of what he's done. But at the moment, we have a Bristol transport strategy, which has just come out there, which talks about buses, and Marvin's made great play about this in his State of the City speech and all the rest. This he's allowed First Bus to take an overall monopoly in the city, because he's put the Metrobus into First Bus as well, and that's caused problems, because Metrobus are finding problems with the Metrobus service and the service that First are running locally. That means that some of those services are being stripped away, and that's because we've got one monopoly for the whole, an institutionalised monopoly for the whole city.
It seems almost designed to get people to go and buy a car.
I couldn't agree with you more. The whole point is that we've got to really offer a meaningful alternative to the car, something that people could, and a lot of people out there want to do this, and at the moment it's simply not being made easy for them, and it's a tragedy.
Before we hear from Martin Summers on transport, let's have a listen to Marvin Rees, the mayor. He won't come on this programme, but he's too busy, and he doesn't like replying to requests to come on either. let's have a listen to what he had to say a few weeks ago in his State of the City speech about transport, his vision for the city.
No administration for years has taken transport seriously. There have been efforts to improve cycling and walking, but it remains difficult to travel from A to B. Communities in areas such as Hartcliffe, Avonmouth and Hillfields remain disconnected. Congestion adversely impacts on the city's economy and air quality. We will not repeat the errors of recent years in pretending that cars will disappear if we make life difficult for car drivers, nor will we ignore the economic impact when we do transport planning. We will have an impact on congestion and on people movement by presenting real choice. We must generate mass transit options that are better, cheaper and easier than car travel. Now, thanks to the efforts of my cabinet lead, Vari Threfel, we have our Bristol Transport Strategy out to consultation, outlining our vision in 2036. We have seen the biggest single order of biogas buses in the UK, and we are leading the way on smart ticketing, contactless payments. 7 out of 10 passengers now board the bus using these payment methods. The key outcomes of the congestion task group are being implemented, including the creation of a transport board that will bring key city transport partners to work more closely with the City Council for future planning. But most importantly, we have a flight path for a phased growth of public transport. The first strand of that growth will be looking at a new deal for bus use. And I can share tonight that we are in the process of working towards a heads of agreement that sets out a joint relationship based on long-term and sustained public-private investment in the bus system. Working with our partners in the West of England, the aim of the agreement will be to double bus usage to 20% of all journeys through enhanced service frequencies on the core network, doubling the frequency on main routes. Greater service stability through increased enforcement of bus lanes and highway improvements. The use of new technology to inform where services are most delayed. Extension of the quality and frequency of services into less well-served area. And a single flat fare zone covering the whole city. Because of Bristol's geography, the less affluent parts of the city on the outer town estates currently pay more than the wealthy areas to travel to and from the city centre. First Bus and ourselves has agreed that we will work towards a standard fare across the city, bringing equality to bus travel. Now, I announced our ambitions for a new mass transit system for Bristol on this night last year, and you would have seen illustrations in the video. I can say the first feasibility study was positive, and we will get the results of the second, more advanced study in December. Now, at this point, I should be clear that what we are talking about before anyone publishes their own version of the London Underground map. We are not talking about the London Tube with 200-metre-long trains. A key element of what makes it possible and quicker to deliver is that we may not even need rails or track. Some automated systems around the world just run by following a simple white line painted on the floor. But we are clearly planning for a segregated mass transit system using tunnels and infrastructure appropriate for Bristol's future needs.
So that's Marvin Rees a couple of weeks ago, his State of the City address, Martin Summers. What he's talking about really here, quite a lot of what he's talking about to do with transport is simply bits and pieces that First Group have come up with. I mean, things that they want to do, he's announcing almost as if it's his plan.
Well, I recognise whoever is running the city, the situation, the system is broken.
And what about the underground?
Well, what about it? I mean, the fact is we should never have privatised the bus system in the 1980s, and a Labour government had 13 years in power and did nothing about that, which is why, of course, there's been a rebellion from the grassroots of the Labour Party saying, why didn't we? Because, of course, in London, they never dared to do the same sort of things they did elsewhere, because it would have been absolutely chaotic, and the city traders and the politicians would have had to suffer. So they didn't do it there. And I understand that the Lib Dem position on Bristol is that it should have a similar setup to the one in London, where they franchise things out, and they've got more control than we've got. They should never have basically privatised. You see, if they shouldn't have privatised national coaches either, because you could have had a national coach system running people to the
here all day hearing about the different things that shouldn't.
Then we get to what Marvin's saying, and that all sounds very good, but the problem is you've got a very weak instrument to carry this out, which is a first bus, which is a monopoly, which is also a profit-taking monopoly.
So,
I noticed the key thing you said there is public-private partnership. Now, I know that's all that's on the table. I know that's he's got to say that. But as a Labour mayor, he ought to be saying, frankly, this is rubbish. And that's what we need to hear, because ultimately this needs to be changed. We need to change the financing of local government so that it's more on a stable basis. We need to have an integrated transport plan. Do you remember John Prescott talked about having an integrated transport plan when the Labour were in power? Nothing came of it, because the lobbies, the vested interests that have been built up now, the private bus companies, etc., the private train companies, are an obstacle to having any serious plan. And that, ultimately, we've got to break the logjam at national level, and then local authorities can be liberated to do what they need to do.
Anything to add, Anthony?
Well, we would certainly support a franchising system. We just want to be more in control of what happens in this city in terms of routes, timetables, and fares. We've looked at the bus quality contracts process as part of that franchising system, and we believe it's got some serious legs. The problem is that we can't do that without national legislation.
The city council would love to have a congestion charge, wouldn't it, really? Because that would bring a massive amount of extra income for you.
We, the Liberal Democrats, wouldn't favour a congestion charge. We tried to get a workplace parking levy worked out, which was stopped by the then government, and I'm afraid private interest here in Bristol. When we were trying to do that in 2007, 2008, 2009, I think, but we certainly would accept the need for a clean air zone in Bristol. But if this is simply just being used as a new name for a way of charging people to come into the city and to salt that money away for another use, we would need to look at that very carefully, because we're very sceptical about that approach.
Well, I'm sceptical too. I don't think there'll be anyone sorting out transport until they've got the congestion charge in place. Anyway, we've talked about transport and particularly the destitute, the unemployed, but what about people who are in low-paid work and unstable work? I was looking at a couple of reports this week about work-related stress, and one of them is in people management, which is people who do personnel. It used to be called personnel anyway. Human resources
HR.
People. Mm. This is saying experts criticise half-hearted attempts to tackle a crisis caused by workload and management style. Also, 85%, this is just looking at the charity sector, workers want a different job. So there's people who are in their jobs, but they don't actually enjoy it, and they're looking constantly for something better. Now, that's obviously a good thing, or maybe better paid, but they're not content where they are, which says a lot about 85%. Not content where they are. Another survey is that workers are comfortable looking for new jobs while they're in their existing job. So they're using their computers in the lunchtime or maybe even during work time to look for new jobs whilst at work. So what this tells me is a lot of people who are in work are really not actually doing something that they want to do, Anthony.
I've been blessed in my life, I have to tell you. I've always had a job which I've really, really relished every day. And there are very my dad worked on a production line in a factory, and I think every day for him was pretty, you know, pretty horrible. But I've been really lucky. I was an architect. I was involved in stuff that I really enjoyed doing almost every working day of my life. So I'm probably the wrong person to ask. Most people, I think, do not have that fantastic opportunity. And most people, I think, do suffer. There's certainly, to my mind, there is a very clear correlation between sickness and being unhappy at work. It's sometimes quite difficult to pin down, but I think there is certainly a parallel between those two situations. And any manager that sees that happening, seeing those numbers going up in his
Martin
team,
Summers,
his or her team, should watch out for that.
Martin Summers, 25% jump in people reporting work related stress in the office.
Well, I mean, this again is another effect of austerity. I mean, productivity is down, and you've also got, you know, unemployment, measured employment is up, but people are basically earning rubbish wages, and they have to have top-ups for what used to be working tax credit, now from universal credit. And, of course, the terms and conditions of work have changed for the worse. You know, people are on zero-hours contracts. They can be sacked at will. There's been a big decrease in people calling in sick, which you think, oh, that's good. But what it means is people are turning up when they're absolutely miserable because they're terrified of losing their jobs. And, of course, the whip hand in the labour market is very much on the gaffer's side now. Very different from the 1960s, for example, when people could get sacked in the morning and go and get another job somewhere else in the afternoon if they didn't like it.
This is where people are taking days off because they're stressed at work. Their health and safety executive revealed this week that 15.4 million working days were lost during 2017 to 2018, a huge increase on the previous year, reported as suffering from work-related stress, depression or anxiety, 240,000 of those representing new cases. The number of days lost to stress was around about 24% up on last year.
Well, I understood that the people reporting in sick had gone down, so maybe I've got that wrong. But in any case, the reality is that many people, especially on low incomes, have a fairly miserable time of it. And that's why, I mean, young people, for example, you know, nearly half of graduates are not in graduate-level jobs. They're working in bars. They're delivering meals, even when they've got degrees in geography or whatever it is, you know. And, of course, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't have degrees in geography. It's just that the economy is firing on one cylinder, and we need a complete transformation of everything. But I mean, that's the big picture.
That complete transformation there, Martin. This sounds a bit like a crack record.
Yeah, he's waving a magic wand, isn't he?
Yeah, I'm not waving a magic wand, but what's going to happen there is a magic money tree. It's called quantitative easing, which has been pushing up the asset values of the asset owning classes magnificently. If you own a house, you've seen it rise in value enormously. And of course, if you own central London, like the Duke of Westminster, you've seen your assets rise massively as a result of the policies that have been pursued. But that's a political decision. It's got nothing to do with the free market at all.
But it's also a legal decision not to tax that increase in wealth.
It is.
I understand there is a concern about raising that situation in the first place. But as I said earlier, what you then need to do is be intelligent enough to address and mitigate that problem. And that, it's the mitigation. It's not actually addressing issues that arise from a situation. That's what's going wrong.
Well, I agree with that. If you're going to have quantitative easing, you've got to take the money off them at the other end. But, of course, that's not been happening. And, of course, the people who've benefited from quantitative easing think they deserve their extra money.
You know what?
Because they're so brilliant.
You know what? I think it's actually become a bit like a feudal system, really, where the people who are dishing out the quantitative easing are dishing it out to the barons, and it's slowly trickling it down to their minions, but it's not getting to anybody else. Anyway, let's move to another subject now. The Health Secretary this week has ordered a probe into autistic youngsters locked in National Health Service hellholes, in inverted commas, across the UK. A mother has revealed her son is so drugged he can hardly move in a care unit. Matt Hancock has ordered an urgent investigation into children being locked up. Children as young as 13 are said to be being incarcerated for years in these NHS units. Barbaric treatment includes patients being kept in isolation in padded cells. Mr. Hancock was deeply shocked by the Daily Mail's account last week of children as young as 13 being incarcerated, sometimes for years, in these NHS-funded assessment and treatment units known as ATUs. The Daily Mail expose, based on numerous detailed interviews with distraught individuals and families, found evidence of routine abuse of kids and young people kept in these secretive facilities. So what do you make of this? It does sound, I mean, you know, this is the Daily Mail. They're saying effectively it's barbaric. Now, surely, Martin Summers, this is not just the Daily Mail saying everything the state does is wrong. What they've done is identified people who've been basically drugged up and then put into cells.
Well, I mean, I haven't read the individual article, and of course autism is an increasingly, you know, we're increasingly aware of it. I work with special needs kids, I'm aware of this. But one of the problems, again, sorry to sound like a crack record, but the Lib Dems here sued Bristol City Council because they weren't fulfilling the statements that had been placed on many special needs kids. And of course the council lost, as they should, but of course that means that the council has got to cut something else in order to fund that. Special needs is one of the things that's gone down the drain. Meanwhile, the Duke of Westminster has doubled, trebled his wealth. And that's a political decision, not an economic decision.
This is a bit of a worrying report in the Daily Mail. I'm not sure if you come across it last weekend and the weekend before, Anthony, but children being locked up for years, some of them,
well, it's
and drugged
it's,
up.
It's an appalling situation, which you've really got to ask yourself is, how can this have happened, and yet, with all of the inspections, with all of the reports and everything else that have to come out through these places, that this should have been allowed to go on and not been discovered before? And I'm just going to correct something said earlier. It wasn't the Lib Dems that actually took the judicial review out against Bristol City Council. We were very supportive
of it. Tim Kent was very involved, wasn't
he? He was indeed, and Tim brought the motion to council which restored that 5 million quid back into the budget, which was taken away from special needs kids because the budget was simply rushed through and ill-considered, and many other things went through that budget last year and may well go through again this year because they're not being, the implications are not being properly considered. So good on Tim, but we didn't actually do the suing, but the that went through, and that was a great result. But it doesn't solve this problem, and this, as you say, autism and the recognition of autism and many other types of mental conditions is now, I'm very pleased to say, getting a little better, and it's, you know, nothing like fast enough. But if this is ending up with the worst people with the worst problems being just banged up somewhere, this is a dreadful, an appalling situation for this century in this country.
It seems to me that the officials involved, civil servants or whoever, are using the whole sort of, you know, the idea that these places have got to be secure just to keep out any kind of scrutiny. There's no proper oversight anymore.
I think the word secure in that situation is probably more about safety to the individual, but nevertheless it doesn't excuse the fact that they're just being squirreled away and they're not being properly assessed, and that's very, very worrying.
Okay, we've got the 100 years since the end of the First World War, just a little milestone to pass this weekend. I wonder what your thoughts are, Anthony. I can never forget Michael Gove, wasn't it, that was talking about how it was a just war, and there was a bit of an argument in the national newspapers between him and various academics saying, well, actually, no, it wasn't a just war, it was a complete and utter waste of life. Where do you stand on all of this?
Well, if wars take 120 years to concoct, as you said earlier, and I don't know where that came from.
Well, we'll see.
Certainly, there were a few weeks where absolutely everything diplomatically seemed to go completely wrong back in 1914, and it's almost inconceivable that so many mistakes and wrongful positions and people getting the wrong side of common sense should have ended up with that appalling carnage. And it's there may be some justification and resistance in the Second World War, but the First World War seems to be in a completely political set of positions being wrongly taken and wrongly addressed, and it ended up, as you say, with incalculable loss of life.
Martin, before we hear from you, let's have a listen to a chap called James Florey. He's from a group called Veterans for Peace. These are groups of soldiers who served in Afghanistan, Iraq, etc. And they're actually meeting today and tomorrow, and they'll be attending the cenotaph on Sunday. The public part of their conference is tomorrow at Friends House in London on Euston Road, and well worth visiting because you'll find lots of ex-service men and women who are giving you, I suppose, their view on what should be done in order to stop these sorts of waste of life, and also their own views on the conflicts which they served in. So let's have a listen now to the former infantryman, James Florey, from Veterans for Peace, who are organising this conference, the public part of which is tomorrow. And this is what he has to say about the whole idea of remembrance.
We're a sophisticated generation. We've learned much. We have much information out there. We have much experience to learn from. We can apply this. We can do this. We can get together. We can try and stop war tomorrow. We can't. I'm not saying we can stop war, but we can try. And that's something that humans need to put their attention to. Not starting wars and not carrying on wars, but stopping wars, because it's the worst thing that humanity can do. It's a failure in humanity, and it really is the very worst thing. It's not just, you know, a glorified call of duty bayonet fighting or whatever. It's utterly miserable. You know, most people that die in wars in these days and since the Second World War are civilians. So we're talking about men, women, children, babies, and they don't have quick deaths either. They suffer terribly, and some people take years to die, and it's smelly and it's dirty and it's humiliating, and that's what war is. And we can stop it collectively as humans because we're better than that.
Well, very sound sentiments, I must say. And what worries me is that the kind of argy-bargy that led to the World War One, we are seeing very much in the international system at the minute, where, you know, treaties are ripped up like the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty by Trump, and the possibility of, you know, a clash between superpowers is probably closer than any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962.
We've had two world wars, Anthony. It couldn't happen again, could it?
Well, it's happening all the time, of course. There's been as much loss of life since the Second War as during the Second War. And the problem is now, I think, or the increasing problem is now, is where it used to be a clash of arms between governments with the possibility of diplomacy and treaties and lines on maps and everything else. What is now happening is increasingly more about much more nebulous things and migration across borders, and it is, as the man said, much more about civilian loss of life. It's not just crossfire anymore. They are considered to be part of the combatants, and that's absolutely unthinkable.
Well, we're talking in the second hour about this figure from the US university, 500,000 dead in Iraq and Pakistan and Afghanistan. Why hasn't anyone gone to jail for that?
Well, that's one of the biggest questions I think I've ever been asked.
Okay.
Because the fog of war is so appallingly dense, and because bigger things are at issue, and it just gets passed by.
Okay,
don't expect me to answer that in 5 seconds.
I'm afraid I was expecting you. It's very cheeky, sorry. Anyway, time for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Thanks to our guests. Guest there is Lib Dem leader and councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus. Join us after the news as Martin takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots.
Radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.